Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter of Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Portmeister, that's Mike Parry, of course, and the rock chip writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, how are you this very fine day?
Warming up a bit, Michael, thank you. It's been a bit cold the last couple of days, hasn't it?
Well, yesterday was a miserable day. I can take it if it's a bit cold, but there's bright sunshine overhead because it lifts everybody's heart, you know? And I love a powder blue sky and the odd fluffy cloud. But yesterday was so grim. I mean, I'm not an advocate of heat and hot weather and heat waves and all that. I like temperate sort of climate. But a miserable day with rain in the air and grey, cloudy, just depresses everybody. That's what it was like yesterday. I have business to attend to today, which will mean gathering outside with people. So I'm rather glad that it's much brighter and breezier.
Yeah, it was wet, wasn't it? And we had, where I live, there was a horrible accident in the village.
Really?
More or less right outside our place. And I had my head hanging out the window. I was giving my daughter a running commentary. I said, rolling news here. You know, you should be grateful for this. I'm your eyes so that you don't have to stand here. But somebody seemed to have been run down by a truck. I got really, really cross because, you know, a double-decker bus does not stop in the middle of the street for no reason. Yeah. So behind the double-decker bus, a trail of cars, obviously loads of people with places to go and, you know, appointments to get to, blah, blah, blah. They can't fathom that the bus is stop there for a reason. They have to overtake on the outside, so swinging around to the right and trying to pass the bus. And of course, then they come bang smack into trouble with a couple of ambulances and three police cars. And then they're all trying to do 3-point turns in the middle of the road and turn around and go back, causing utter mayhem. But worse than that, almost knocking down several cyclists off their bikes in their fury to get away from this mess. I think people are becoming more and more selfish on the roads, and it's sickening to see.
Yeah, well, people's nerves are shredded and frayed at the moment because of lockdown. People are impatient. People want life to start up again and get back to its normal pace as quickly as possible. So I agree there is that. So, sorry, did the bus knock somebody down then?
No. The bus was proceeding in the other direction, and it appeared to be a truck. Somebody, you know, there are railings along the road to make sure that people can find themselves to the pavements.
Yeah.
It looked to me as though this person had sort of run on the outside of the railings and got knocked down. But I couldn't find anything online about it, so I don't know what the outcome was.
Yeah, well, to be honest, we all think that we see major incidents on the roads, but they're tiny compared to what's going on in the rest of the world. I've often thought, I wonder where all these police cars are going to when the blue lights are flashing and they're speeding along at twice and three times the speed limit. And I always keep an eye open, an ear open, as you will, because we are professional journalists and, you know, we're naturally curious about things. I never see reports of what might have happened for all those police cars to have been dashing to. You know what I mean? I sometimes wonder whether they just do it occasionally just to test out their lights.
Oh, they're late for tea. That's all.
Well, I'm not going to denigrate the police. They do a fine job, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, they do. But I sometimes see there's a sweet shop that I pass quite often, quite a famous sweet shop. And you very often, and this really annoys me, see a police car pulled up on double yellow lines outside the sweet shop.
and they're getting the sweets.
Exactly. Yeah. Why are they allowed to park on double yellow lines to go in and get sweets?
Well, it shows the police have a human heart. The only real road accident.
Does it really?
Yeah, well, it does. Yeah. Anybody who likes a bag of, you know, pineapple chunks or something like that.
Not a euphemism.
Not a euphemism at all. A sherbet dip, perhaps.
We're getting saucy here now.
No, not at all. I tell you what, do you remember your favourite sweet shop as a child? And it was like walking into Aladdin's cave, wasn't it?
Yeah, we had a Woolworths on the high street town where I lived. Yes. Mm. And they were the very early pick and mixes, weren't they? And I used to absolutely love two things. Those little white milk bottles that used to
bring. Oh, yes, I love those, yeah.
Chewy, really love those.
Yeah.
And the pink prawns, whatever they're made of.
I love them.
Carcinogenic crap, probably, but I absolutely loved them.
But never mind the pink prawns. The pink prawns disappeared the moment I found the yellow bananas. You know, no,
come on, it's too early in the day for that kind of thing.
You know what I mean? I mean, they were even nicer. But walking home from school, we'd always pass Mr. and Mrs. Smith's, and it was their sweet shop, believe it or not. They had, you know, the other most common name in the world, other than yours, Jones, you know, is Smith in this country. It was Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
I thought it was Williams. I thought maybe Williams was.
No, it will be in your country, Wales, Williams, but but in England, it's Smith and Jones. And they wore white coats, like as if they were laboratory attendants, you know what I mean? And all the sweets were stacked up on the counter in front of them. And then all the bottles, you know, with all the, like I said, pear drops, pineapple chunks, you know, mints and all that were all surrounded around them. It was like walking into Aladdin's cave. It was wonderful. And also, I remember the smell was so beautiful. You know, the sweets always smelled so lovely.
Very perfumed. I've told you before, haven't I, about my great uncle Bryn, who was a big star at Arsenal and played for Wales and so on.
Yeah, you told me about him, yeah.
In those days, obviously, there wasn't much money in the game for players themselves.
Yes.
And when Uncle Bryn retired, he had a sweet shop on Green Lanes in North London.
Oh, I know where that is. That's up near Palmer's Green, where I used to live.
It's a great long road. It's probably the longest road in London, I should
say. It is. It goes all the way from sort of the city right up to sort of Enfield. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, Southgate as well. Yeah. And he had the sweet shop. And when we were very little kids, it was a real treat for my dad to drive us over from Kent, where we lived, to go and visit Uncle Bryn. And to go and get a bag of sweets from his shop. And he had all the sweets in big jars behind the counter, on the shelves behind his head. About 3 years ago, I was ghostwriting a book for a criminal lawyer, a woman, very talented lady. And we were talking about her childhood. And she said, oh, you know, I had a terrible time at home. My parents were abusive. I used to go after school to this sweet shop on Green Lanes, and he used to get the Beano for me in there because it was kind of a newsagent's as well.
Yeah.
And I used to get a fab lolly. Do you remember those fab lollies that were sort of pink and creamy white with sprinkles all over them? I used to get one of those.
Yeah.
And I used to steal money once a week from my mum's purse to go in and pay him. Yep. And he used to let me sit there and read the Beano and have a bag of sweets. And all the hairs were standing up on the back of my neck. And I suddenly said, I know that sweet shop. And she said, how the hell do you know that sweet shop?
Yeah.
I said, my uncle owned it. She said, what was his name? I said, Bryn Jones. She said, no. And she burst into tears. She went running out in the kitchen to call her husband. And she was going, get in here. Listen to this. She said, Bryn Jones. And he welled up as well. And this place turned out to have been a sort of Aladdin's cave to all these local kids who had nowhere else to go. And he was very kind to them in a very benign way, very innocently. You know, nowadays people would be suspicious of that kind of thing.
Sure.
If an old man was being kind to kids.
Sure.
But that was where they all went as a little refuge to get away. Wasn't that a coincidence?
Amazing coincidence. I mean, a lot of coincidences in your life, Miss Jones. I think fate must smile on you kindly and make you a sort of almost like an angel delivered from heaven to pull people together in various situations.
Oh, don't overdo it.
Well, you know, there we are. Now, talking about dangerous situation. No, I didn't say dangerous situation. Nice situation. But a dangerous situation for me, Leslie Ann, would be getting into a driverless car. So when I read driverless cars will be travelling on Britain's roads by the end of the year, you won't get me. Honestly, I would rather step into a space rocket untested on top of a million gallons of fuel than I would get into a driverless car.
I know what you're saying. I mean, some cities in America have got these self-driving minibuses already in places like Vegas and San Francisco.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, these sort of ride-hailing services happen for a couple of years. It's coming, whether we're ready or not, is the thing.
Yeah.
Like a lot of people back in the day, I remember when I was a child, they said they'd never get a colour television. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And of course, the thought of sitting watching a black and white television set now is unthinkable. Yeah. So I think we're just not ready yet, but I think it's coming. And I think I think we probably will get in them. Yes.
Well, it's an age thing, obviously. Any young kid, 17 or 18, would leap into one of them. It'd be a big adventure because it's like being a Spitfire pilot at 21. You're never going to get shot down, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But not really for me. But I do understand exactly what you mean. That, you know, some things happen. I mean, even when we started as newspaper reporters, if somebody had told us 40 years later, oh, don't worry, you'll be able to get hold of the office in future with a little bit of plastic in your pocket measuring 3 inches by 6 inches, and you just take it out and you press a button and you can talk to your news desk, we'd have laughed at anybody who thought that technology could ever be possible.
Unthinkable. I remember being on the Eurostar about 10, 12 years ago now, and my agent phoned me, and it struck me as so unusual. Here I am sitting on a train in France.
Yes.
My agent actually was in South Africa at the time, my literary agent.
Yeah.
And he was in South Africa. He was continents away. And there we were having a conversation on, as you say, a little bit of credit card sized plastic.
Yeah.
Absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely extraordinary. Talk about traveling and phones, by the way. But I mean, it doesn't happen these days. But did you ever use, you know, the phone in your seat on a transatlantic airliner and ever managed to get through to anybody in London when you were, 35,000 feet above the Atlantic?
I did try that once. You had to put your credit card in.
Yeah, that's right.
And
yeah.
They were big sort of unwieldy things in the back of the seat in front. And
yeah.
A bit like, do you remember the Virgin flights where they used to bring you a selection of videos around?
Yes, I do,
so you could choose a film.
That's right.
I mean, absolutely. Nowadays, all that is just a little button and your armrest, isn't it?
No, I totally agree. I used one of those phones once, not because I wanted to speak to anybody. I wanted to impress some woman back in England, that I was.
I'm phoning you from the 747.
That's right. Yeah, it's exactly that. I'm in business class in the 747. Just like a quick call, baby, let you know how things are, amongst the jet set up here, and all that kind of stuff. And it took about an hour to make it work. And in the end, I did make it work, but only after, I'd called a flight attendant, a trolley dolly, as they used to be known. But of course, I wouldn't.
Oh, no, you can't say that.
No, I wouldn't resort to that. No. I'm totally against all that. Don't worry. And, one of the old flight attendants would have to show me 6 or 7 times how to make this blinking phone work. And then eventually when it rang through, the joy of saying, oh, hello,
she
Lorraine,
was out.
Or something like that.
She wasn't home. Oh, no, he's not going to answer the phone. Oh, God, he does annoy me when he just does this.
Yes.
Come on.
I don't know what's going on here. Hang on. Right, that's gone. It was one of those fake calls. Anyway, I can tell from the way the number came up. People know not to call me when I'm recording with you, Leslie Ann. So it wasn't anybody.
Yeah, but complete strangers don't know not to call you, do they?
Well, that wasn't a stranger. That was one of those bum numbers, selling something.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, so the sheer joy of saying, oh, hi, Lorraine. It's Mike here. Yeah, how are you? What are you up to? And then,
well, you're not going to have a bit of phone sex in front of a whole.
No, you're not.
A whole crew of people in Well, I suppose you were in business class, weren't you, in those days?
Yes, I was. Yeah, and then of course you're just waiting for this young lady to ask the killer question. Yeah. Oh, where are you? And then, oh, funny you should ask. As I peer out through the window, I can see only fluffy clouds below me and a blue sky above. I'm halfway across
and
the Atlantic.
Just joined the Mile High Club, all by myself.
Oh, Miss Jones, please, honestly, let's move on to something else, for goodness sake, Anyway, listen, I tell you what, old Boris has got himself to right old pickle, hasn't he? Now, nobody's prejudging what's going on, but I can't believe that. Look, I'm not saying that, women bring you problems and all that. But if Boris had never met Carrie and was still with his former wife, Marina, and hadn't been playing around and was a, solidly married family man, it's true to say that this problem would never have happened, because his partner, Carrie, who in my mind had every right to want to redecorate her living quarters for the next 5 years, is the source of the problem. I think it's the rules that are wrong, not Boris and Carrie.
It's a bit of a minefield, this, isn't it? I mean, we haven't seen the actual interiors of number 11 for a start.
Ghastly pictures of.
No, we haven't. All we've seen are pictures of the kinds of designs that Lulu Little comes up with.
We've not
seen the actual interior.
Yeah, that's right.
But the thing is, Marina, if he'd stayed with her, is highly likely to have wanted to redecorate as well.
Sure.
So I don't think we can pour all this all over Carrie. But I think it was ill-advised of them in the first place to even think about redecorating during a pandemic when thousands of people are losing their lives, coming up with all kinds of problems because of illness, lockdowns, all the rest of it. It really was an irrelevance, and it shouldn't ever have been done.
But
I think they could have waited.
could have started before the pandemic. The minute they got into Downing Street, Carrie will have said, "Oh God, I can't stand all this." What did she describe it as? Very John Lewis. Well, that's a bit harsh on John Lewis.
Well, it's a bit of a stupid thing to say, frankly, as well, because John Lewis is an emporium. It doesn't purvey a single actual style. Mm. You can buy all kinds of branded goods from all kinds of manufacturers in there. Mm. It is very mid-market as an outlet. It's not Harrods, but Harrods doesn't purvey a particular style either. You can buy all kinds of brands. So it was a pointless statement, really. And all these people now criticising that and saying, oh, is John Lewis down market? Well, John Lewis is not a style. It's a shop. Yes. So I don't get the comment in the first place.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't know John Lewis from Marks and Spencer's, to be honest, in terms of goods that are bought there.
Well, that's kind of mid-market as well, isn't it?
Well, I suppose so, yeah.
But it's not a luxury brand, is it?
No. But, you know, it's such a load of nonsense, because he has achieved much, Boris Johnson, including, you know, being overall in charge of the rollout programme. And all you've got are people sniping at a blinking, you know, roll of wallpaper. And the other thing is, Dyson, the engineer, the brilliant James Dyson, Sir James Dyson, brilliant billionaire businessman through his genius and his hard work, he is not a Tory party donor. What happened was, he said, look, I'll get you these ventilators, but of course I've got to be careful about, you know, lumbering my company with all sorts of tax bills for importing the ventilators. What can we do about that, Boris? And Boris said, yeah, get on with it. But James Dyson was very angry in a newspaper piece I read yesterday that the BBC had branded him a Tory donor. He said, I hadn't been a Tory donor. I just wanted to help the country. So it's an awful lot of dirty politicking here, in my view.
Yeah, there is. And I think we're missing the point, aren't we? It's like trying to get him to admit that he said those words.
Yes.
This is the bodies piled high statement.
Yes.
I mean, there is a rule in place that ministers who knowingly mislead Parliament are expected to offer their resignation.
Exactly.
And also MPs are banned from accusing each other of lying in the House. But all of that is going on right now. People are accusing him of lying. And there are now said to be MPs who are willing to go to oath.
Yeah.
Do you know what it reminds me of?
What?
Bill Clinton, I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
That's exactly the first thing that came to my mind, honestly. I remember Bill pointing his finger at the interlocutor and saying those exact words, and it reminded me of the same. I think because he stood up in the House and said, I did not say those words, he must have a cast-iron assurance within himself that the so-called three witnesses are never going to speak out publicly. He must, because otherwise he's done for. It'll only take one of those to step forward in front of a TV camera and say, no, I definitely heard him say that, and Boris Johnson's finished. So there must be something going on in the background that will ensure that if those three people do exist, they're never going to speak publicly.
Well, even worse, if somebody captured it on their phone.
Well, that's the only person who could have done that, I would imagine, is Dominic Cummings. He's up in front of MPs next month. But I believe because he is so wild and uncontrollable and venomous and bitter about leaving Downing Street, I think that would have come out by now.
I think you're right. But he hasn't done himself any favours at all.
No, none whatsoever. He looks like a vindictive little child, you know, who lost his job and then been stamping his feet ever since and going around telling everybody, I told you so, you know, I warned you and all that kind of stuff. I think he's a most repulsive man.
What's his motive?
His motive is just anger, revenge, humiliation, the walk out of Downing Street holding a cardboard box, but also the anger at what he tells people is, I won the Brexit election with my strategy. I won the general election with my strategy and gave him an 80-seat majority. What was my reward for all that? I was booted out of Downing Street, summarily booted out. And he was booted out because actually he fell out with Carrie and her group of supporters, who felt that the way he was working inside Downing Street was brusque, brutal, undisciplined, offensive, unpleasant, and all those sort of things.
Yeah, doesn't it all evoke that age-old adage that you want these enemies inside your tent pissing outwards?
Yes, I think the expression is, we'd rather have you in the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in, yeah?
That's what I just said.
Well, sort of. But in a more
no, that is what I just said.
Oh, did you?
Those exact words. Yeah, you weren't listening again.
Oh, well, my hearing must be going. listen, just on that, that's interesting because only this morning you talked about officers and all that. I read this story. Bosses like Brent are best. That is a fact. David Brent-style bosses with cringeworthy banter are actually the best managers, research claims. The study by Policy Institute Hack Future found that bosses who put fun and friendship before productivity are substantially more likely to retain staff. I have to say, Leslie Ann, in our careers, or certainly mine in Fleet Street, I never found one boss out of hundreds who put fun and friendliness before anything else. Did you?
No, not really. I mean, there were some who used to try and curry favour with you and they all that. Yeah, that word banter. We didn't have that word back then, did we?
No, but we didn't, no.
They'd sort of cozy up to you and try and be chummy and all that. I used to find that kind of thing really creepy. Nowadays, you can go to HR about that sort of thing and complain about them. But yeah, there were some who were a bit over familiar with the girls in the office.
Yes, there were.
And that was never very comfortable.
No, I totally agree. But most of the bosses I worked for or most of the people I worked for were just nasty and vicious. You know better than I do. Fleet Street was an incredibly vicious and nasty competitive arena. Everybody sort of tearing lumps out of each other and backstabbing them and going and tittle-tattling on them to other people and all that kind of stuff. I found it very unpleasant. In fact, at some of the papers I worked at, people simply wouldn't come and join that paper because the reputation of the editor was so horrific they had no desire to put themselves into the firing line.
The thing I hated the most was creative tension. You know, they'd set two of you in competition with each other on the same story, knowing that you were friends, and in some cases you sat together on the bench, especially when we had the showbiz desk at the Daily Mail, which we all sat round one big desk, which was about eight desks pushed together.
Sure.
So we were all facing each other with our massive great Olivetti typewriters in the middle.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, your mate, you'd suddenly be sent out on the same story with them, and you had to try and get the story ahead of that person.
Yes.
So it caused bad feeling in the office all the time.
Yeah.
I never saw the point of that.
No, neither did I. There was always those sort of power games. You're right. When I was first made a deputy news editor on The Express, the guy who was in charge of sort of all news and like that, he said, "Oh, I think we'll find you another colleague." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Yeah, I think we'll have another deputy news editor." And I said, "Why would you have another deputy news editor? I'm either the deputy news editor or I'm not. I'm not sharing the title." He said, "Oh, don't get like that." He said, "It'll take the weight off your shoulder." I said, "No, it won't." Well, what's your game? What's the game that, you know, you delegate down a decision and the two of us fight over it? I said, "I'm not having it." I said, "You appoint anybody you want as deputy news editor, but there's only one and that's me. And if you bring somebody else in, I'll go and do something else. Thank you." And the idea disappeared. But that came from Paul Dacre. Paul Dacre at the Mail, right? He was the editor, obviously. He had about two or three deputies and he used to love setting them against each other and see which one would come first and try and curry favour with him by, solving some problem.
It was a very unhealthy environment. And those guys, you know, they would sell their own grandmother for the sake of a front page hit. They really would.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he fostered that, Dacre, and he was in charge of that whole stance, which is a very unpleasant way to work.
Yes, I totally agree. You know, if you go to work every morning, you go through the door and you've got to steel yourself and think, ooh, you know, what nastiness, what viciousness, what have I got to watch out today about a knife landing in my back and all that? It is an horrendous atmosphere. I don't know why I put up with it for 30 years, to be honest. But anyway, there we are. Right, OK, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky, myself and, of course, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, turning to a showbiz story and one that fascinates me. We have spoken on this podcast before about our mutual love for Riverdance and what a fantastic spectacle it is. I've still got my original Riverdance video, okay? And it's got a picture on the front of it of Michael Flatley and the lady who was co-dancer to Michael Flatley, Jean Butler, okay? And I remember the shock and awe of seeing their first performance together in the first Riverdance video, where Michael Flatley sprints onto the stage and starts Irish dancing to be joined shortly afterwards by this beautiful, tall and elegant woman in a short black dress, because that's what Irish dancers wear. called Gene Butler. Now, Michael Flatley, of course, went on to massive worldwide fame and fortune by inventing other stage shows and receiving millions of pounds for the choreography of Riverdance and all sorts of things. But I read a piece about Gene Butler just a couple of days ago about what happened to her. Where did she disappear to? In fact, she was only in Riverdance for 3 years and then shied away from public life. That's a bit of a shame, isn't it?
Well, she was dancing, Gene Butler, long before she met Michael Flatley, and she was dancing long after him. She did leave Riverdance in 1997. I know that because my son was born that year, and I went to see it 3 times. I was amazed, like you. But after Riverdance, she had her own show called Dancing on Dangerous Ground. Do you remember that one? It was based on the ancient Irish legend of Dermot and Grania, and that was a sensation in its own right. And she did these Irish dance masterclasses DVDs.
Yeah.
You could have done one of those. You could have been Stavros Flatley, couldn't you?
I would have been more like Stavros Flatley, certainly.
Do you remember them on Britain's Got Talent, wasn't it?
Yeah. The dad came on first, a Greek guy with a bandana around his head, started dancing. Everybody thought, what's the point of this? And then his 10-year-old son suddenly leaps on stage, mini me. And it was very funny, wasn't it?
You could have done that.
Yeah,
well, you and I could have done that.
Yes, we had better things to do in those days.
Well, I suppose we did.
Yeah.
But no, she went back to Ireland because her mother was from County Mayo.
Right.
And she did a master's degree at the University of Limerick in contemporary dance performance. I mean, that is dedication because she could dance already.
Yeah.
But she went back to get her master's. And I think what's been great about her is that she has upheld the purity of traditional Irish dance.
Yes.
Whereas Michael Flatley was all about making it a bit more rock and roll, wasn't he?
Well, it was certainly very entertaining, though, as you've already alluded to.
Yeah. And she did retire from active dancing in 2010. And she's been in a few films. She's designed jewellery. She's obviously a very creative woman.
Yes, sure.
Somebody I'd like to meet, actually.
Oh, yeah, no, I totally agree. I've got huge admiration for Michael Flatley. Not only was he recognised as the greatest Irish dancer in the world. Did you know that he was also like an award-winning flautist? You know, he played the flute and he played it brilliantly, apparently. He's got about, like, you know, a collection of 12 different flutes and all that. But also he was a great commercial businessman. The other thing, of course, I liked a lot about Michael Flatley was that when I read something about him a couple of years ago, he admitted, and I don't think any of us would have suspected it, that an awful lot of shagging went on amongst the cast of Riverdance as they toured the world, because half of them were young men and half of them were young women.
Yeah, you do surprise me.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, I get that he, among his fellow professionals, was not terribly popular, shall we put it that way?
But he was ruthless, wasn't he? And he was demanding, and he was a perfectionist. And people like that get reputations for being not very nice, but in fact, they're just perfectionists. They want to do it right.
But you can't bully people.
No, you can't bully people. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why Gene Butler left. Not that I'm suggesting that Michael Flatley bullied her, but I think she found their working relationship tough.
Yeah. And moving swiftly on. In her case, very swiftly on with feet like that.
Yeah. With feet like that. Moving on, I've got it. You know, God, I don't know.
It took you a minute there, didn't it?
Well, you're just too fast for me. Now, listen, I shouldn't say listen, should I? I'm going to say, perhaps give me your view, Leslie Ann Jones, on one of your favourite topics, which is Wales. Why on earth do the Welsh want to rename Snowdon Weird Waffy-y?
Well, look, this has just been going on for a long time. This is the Welsh reclaiming their heritage and their language. It has always had an alternative name.
Yeah.
It Snowdon is an English word, okay?
Yeah.
So it's just a linguistic thing. Cardiganshire, which we have long known as Cardiganshire, it's actually Ceredigion. You've got places like Aberystwyth and Aberarran in that area, which have always retained their Welsh names, and those haven't ever been changed.
Yes.
Cardiff, we tend to say, but that's actually Caerdydd.
Yes.
Swansea is in reality Abertawe. I bet you didn't know that one.
No, I didn't know. No.
And the Brecon Beacons in Wales.
Yeah.
Forgive me, I'm not a Welsh speaker, so forgive me if I mispronounce this, but it's actually Banaw Brycheiniog. And those names have always existed. I think they're just probably promoting them a bit more now, because in Wales, they do like to speak Welsh.
Well, they do, but I mean, not many people do. I always laugh.
Oh, yeah, they do.
Yeah, when I go to Cardiff, I always laugh. Oh, look, there's the road sign in English and below it, the road sign in Welsh. Now, that is insulting to the Welsh people, Leslie Ann, because that means that basically the authorities are assuming that a lot of people who live in Cardiff and Swansea are too thick to have ever learnt the English language. And therefore, we've got to write things in Welsh for them because these are just Welsh peasants who don't know any better. I think that's insulting.
You've misunderstood. My father was born Welsh. His parents were born Welsh. Yeah. His grandparents were born Welsh. But they were in the south of Wales and they never spoke Welsh. They spoke English. Yeah. Because English had been imposed by the English.
Imposed? Come on.
Dating
you sound
way
like
back.
William Wallace. You can take our freedom, but you cannot take our language.
You don't allow me to finish a sentence.
Sorry,
which you
please,
ought to, because you would understand where I was going with this.
Well, go on.
Dating right back to the 16th century, yeah. English was brought to Wales and imposed. But in the Mid Wales and in North Wales, they do speak Welsh as their first language. Mm. And so the further away you go from down south, the more likely you are to encounter primarily Welsh-speaking people. Yeah. I would love to learn Welsh. I haven't really got time at the moment. And my father always said he would love to learn his own language,
yeah.
but never got round to it. And now he can't. So,
yeah.
Or maybe he can, for all we know.
There's a presenter on GMB, Good Morning Britain. I can't remember his name now. Young fella. And he speaks Welsh, fluent Welsh. And it's because his wife is Welsh. So he decided to learn the language when they go home to see her parents and all that, which I think is quite noble, isn't it?
It sounds beautiful. I have a real aversion to people in broadcasting who sound like fake Welsh people. And there's one in particular who so annoys me, I have to turn the radio off when she comes on,
yeah.
is Ceres Matthews.
Oh, yes.
She just sounds like a Disney Welsh person. And I'm a bit rubbed up the wrong way by Alex Jones on The One Show as well.
Alex, yeah, yes, that's right. Yeah, she's made a very big success, hasn't she, over the years and all that kind of stuff.
She seems a perfectly nice person,
yeah.
but I just don't like her Welsh accent. It just seems like overdone. You know, Welsh people are quite more...
Like Hugh Edwards, maybe.
Hugh's got a lovely accent.
That's what I mean.
I know Hugh.
Yeah.
We had sons in the same class at school.
Right.
He's a lovely, lovely person. He's just how he comes across on screen.
Yeah, sure.
And his accent is very understated and it sounds elegant, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. I can do a Welsh accent, you know. Hello, boyo. How are you today? Have you been down the farm? And have you seen the sheep? And how are we getting on? What is the weather going to be like today?
It's always sheep involved, isn't it?
Well, there's lots of sheep in Wales. There's more sheep in Wales than anywhere else in the world, basically. But no, I had a mate called, what's his name? He's such a good mate, I forgot his name. And I worked with him at TalkSport and he went off to work with Sky. And then unfortunately, he got sort of blown up in the incident involving Andy Gray and Richard Keys. And he's now ended up out in Qatar with them. And a lovely boy named Rodri, okay? So there's a good Welsh name. And he came from a good Welsh family. They ran businesses in Wales, like bars and restaurants and all that kind of stuff. And Rodri spoke absolutely fluent Welsh. So, for instance, sometimes we'd get a Welsh rugby player on, and just for a bit of a laugh, Rodri and the Welsh rugby player would converse in Welsh for 30 seconds, you know, just because people like the sound of it. But anyway, there we are.
It is a lovely sounding language, yes.
Oh, it is,
it's quite difficult to learn. I think also it's very hard to learn a language in your middle years. It's the time you should learn a language is in your first 5 years of life. So ideally, if you've got parents mixed kind of heritage, you know, going on. If you've got, say, an Italian mother and an English father, the mother does very well to teach the child, to speak to the child in Italian.
Sure.
And by the time he's five, he's fluent in Italian as well as English.
Yeah.
That's the time to learn.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. Now, we spoke before about, what age is sensible at to stop becoming a parent. How about this? Howard Donald is 53. He's obviously the singer. On becoming a father again in middle age, he said recently, I've really struggled with it and I would never advise anyone in their 50s to have young children. That's quite a frank statement, isn't it? Which might come back and you know, kick him in the teeth when the child he's talking about is of a, you know, a teenage age or something.
Yeah, I think if you're a celebrity, you ought to be a bit wary of making statements like that, because your child is always going to find that in the cuttings in future.
Yes.
I think that we shouldn't be too hung up on age. One man's 70s is another man's 45. You know, we can't judge these things by the numbers. I know 60-year-olds who outstrip 40-year-olds in energy and health-wise and so on. There's always been too much emphasis on the numbers in the media. Joan Collins is my role model. She's 87. Sure. And she's always said, ignore the numericals, be who you are.
Yeah.
So I think some men would be perfectly fit in their 50s to father a child, whereas others would be past it.
Yeah.
I think we shouldn't go by the numbers.
No, okay, I agree. I've got the stats here. He's got his eldest child is 22, and his youngest child is a little lad called Dougie Bear, who is 4. So that's an 18-year difference between children, which, you know, I suppose. Talking about that, I noticed Jon Snow, not the best friend of mine, we've talked about that before, has also become a father at the age of 71.
Well, that might be pushing it a bit.
Well, we have talked about that as well. You know, people like Rupert Murdoch have had children in their 70s, all that kind of stuff, and seem to...
Well, is he 90 now? I mean, theoretically, if Jerry wasn't in her 60s, if he had a younger wife, which would be a bit gross, but if he had a younger wife, he could theoretically father further children.
Well, Bernie Eccleston has, hasn't he? I think Bernie Eccleston had a child in his late 80s. And you know, I although I've never had children, so I don't know about the trials of it and all that, and the love and the despair and all that kind of stuff. But to start fatherhood again in your late 80s, I can only admire the man and say, well, he's kind of gone for it, isn't he? Talking about
it's a bit selfish, though, isn't it? It is selfish.
I think so, but I can't.
You're not going to live long enough to see them grow up and to be there for them and support them and so on.
Yeah. Well, you know, as I say, I can't speak as having not been a parent, but I would have thought so. Yeah. Talking about parenting and all that. A guy who I have an awful lot of respect for is Ian Wright, the footballer. Have you ever come across Ian?
I've never met him, no, but I've watched him a fair amount on television.
Yeah. He's a great guy. I've worked with him pretty extensively. We did the Champions League final in, which one was it? It was in Greece, in Athens, and it was the one that Liverpool lost the year after the dramatic final in which they were 3-0 down and eventually won 4-3. Do you remember that? That was the most amazing Champions League final in history. It was 3-0 down at half-time, start of the second half, Steven Gerrard headed Liverpool a consolation goal, 3-1, and then Liverpool went and drew 3-all and won on penalties. Most amazing. Rafael Benitez was the Liverpool manager. The following year, or maybe the year after that, they got to another Champions League final. It was in Athens against the same team, AC Milan, and they lost it. But Ian Wright and I did the whole thing together over 3 days, the shows and all that kind of stuff, you know. And getting out of Athens was a nightmare because it's not the most efficient airport in the world. And there were tens of thousands of Liverpool fans there and Italian fans. It was absolutely packed, you know. Anyway, I had to guide Ian home, not that he's not capable of doing it himself, but we went into the airport and he got mobbed, and I mean mobbed, by Liverpool fans. He never played for Liverpool. He played for Arsenal for most of his career. He played for Crystal Palace and then Arsenal. And you know what? Over the space of the next 2 hours, we managed to corner off a table, you know, in the corner of the little lounge they had there, and the authorities helped us. They knew who Ian Wright was. He played for England 33 times. And they got a couple of, you know, little sort of barriers. And then one by one, the Liverpool fans were allowed to come through and have their picture taken with Ian, or have an autograph, or use a phone call to ring their dad back home to say, I'm with Ian Wright. He did all of that over the space of 2 hours and never flinched. A lovely guy.
Well, that's very kind of him. A lot of them would have just, you know, run into the VIP enclosure and slammed the door.
Indeed they would, yeah. But that's the sort of guy he is. Anyway, the reason I say that is I've read quite a remarkable piece about Ian. He's got a new TV show. A new game show called Moneyball has been revived and he's doing that. But he talks about his relationship with his parents, and particularly his stepfather. And he says that his stepfather was a terrible bully and used to pick on him and persecute him. And even, and this is one that really got me, if his stepfather thought he'd misbehaved in some way, he'd make him stand facing the wall with instruction not to turn round during the whole of Match of the Day, which was Ian's favourite programme as a teenager, you know. And things like that make my blood run cold. Horrendous, horrible bullying, but not of the physical type, you know what I mean?
Psychological bullying.
Yes.
I think the thing is, we all suffered treatment in childhood of that kind. I remember being stood in the corner many, many times. At school, in front of a whole class of kids, I'd have to stand in the corner facing the wall and stuff. I think back then, you know, I was smacked often. I had my hair pulled quite a lot. I was chased to my room. I got locked in. There was a lot of verbal abuse. My mum.
Good God. Yeah.
I had very long hair, and that was a thing they did in those days. And
I
think that it wasn't just deprived and abusive families that poor Ian seems to have come from. But I think that kind of behaviour was rife. It was just considered normal. Nowadays, we'd consider it verbal abuse, we'd consider it law breaking. But there was an awful lot of that kind of thing back then. I'm sure you suffered some of it as well.
I immediately recognised what Ian's saying, because my father had an obsession with education. I mean, an absolute obsession. You know what I mean? He thought you should be doing 3 hours of homework a night. He thought weekends you should, you know, be taking mock tests for the O-levels and A-levels that were to come and all this kind of stuff. Absolute obsession. And as a kid, as young as sort of 11 or 12, if I came home with a bad school report, I got the full treatment. First of all, it was the shouting. Then it was the quiet treatment. One time, he didn't speak to me for 5 days because it was his blind fury at the fact I'd brought home a bad school report. And over the decades since then, I've thought about why he used to get so very angry about it and bawl and shout and tell me I was, you know, couldn't go out on my bike, and then he wouldn't speak to me for 5 days, the cold treatment, even around the dinner table, you know, he'd speak to everybody else but me. And I thought, what? And it was all because he found it a reflection of his own failures.
Yeah, I think there was a lot of that. And I think people taking out their own disappointments on their children.
Yes.
That was rife. I knew a lot of people who were being treated similarly by their parents. And I think actually we can't really blame the parents either. They didn't know better, and they'd probably suffered worse. I remember my mother telling me about her father, my grandfather, who I absolutely adored. He was a very lovely, funny, benign man. But she said, you know, he was a bastard when we were young. He used to take his belt off to us.
Yeah, I know. I think it was more than just the education thing with my father. He had something against me as his son. And that manifested itself when I rang up to tell my mum and dad that I'd got a job on the Daily Express in Manchester. Now, in those days, that was the height of achievement. You know as well as I do, Leslie Ann, how you had to fight like mad and struggle to get up the old greasy pole in Fleet Street and all that kind of stuff. And 360 people applied for this job that was advertised in the UK Press Gazette. And I had three interviews with Stan, I've forgotten his name now, Stan somebody, who was the news editor in the Daily Express in Manchester. And after the third one, about 5 days later, this letter arrived, dropped on my door, offering me the job. Couldn't believe it. I was so thrilled. And I rang up my parents to tell them. And my father actually said, really? What, they've offered you a job on the Daily Express? I said, yeah. He said, you didn't tell us you'd applied for it. I said, well, you know, I didn't want to because I didn't know whether I was going to get it or not. I said, I hope to, but it was very competitive. He said, so when did you start? I said, well, in about a month's time. I said, I'll clear things up. He said, right, that's it. I'm changing to the Daily Mail. I said, what?
What?
Honest to God. He said, no, I read the Express because it's the newspaper of the empire, founded by Beaverbrook, got us through the war. The Daily Express shouldn't employ people like you to write for it. And put the phone down on me.
Unbelievable. No, that's horrible.
Yeah, I know.
That's horrible. I'm so sorry for you.
Well, you know, I'd come to expect it by then, and you kind of get over it. But that was the attitude my father had to me all my life. You know, that, you know, you've got to succeed. But when I did succeed, he didn't like it, actually, because it was a kind of reflection on how his life had gone and all that kind of stuff. But anyway,
of course, it flagged up his own failings.
Yeah,
but
the
thing is, you say you get over it and you move on, but you don't, because you're still talking about it. You've carried that around with you your whole life.
Well, not really. It's only because I read the story about Ian, it sort of triggered something. I don't think about it every day or anything like that.
No, but it's still in there, is what I mean. And it can rise to the surface very easily. I'm sorry for you.
Well, don't worry about it. Please don't be sorry for me. I've had a great life. We can't let a podcast go without our...
Oh, he's such a hard man, isn't he?
Such a hard man, tough guy. Without a Beatles story, this is a great one because it's about Ringo. Ringo Starr has revealed he and his super-rich Beatles bandmates had to lie on top of each other to stay warm in their tour van before they ever hit the jackpot with their careers. Describing life on the road in a new documentary, What Drives Us, Ringo, who was in the Fab Four with McCartney, Harrison and Lennon, said, "You know what was crazy? We always drove home." And he tells a story about they were driving around in this completely clapped out old van, so clapped out that the windscreen cracked and fell out one night. So they were open completely to the elements and they had to lie on top of each other to stop each other freezing to death. I mean, fantastic story.
Yeah, it's very interesting from Ringo because he's always said he can't remember anything about the old days, which is why he's never written his autobiography. So I wonder what has prompted his sudden memory surge.
Perhaps somebody's come forward. This is the thing he's doing
with a bunch of money. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. Yeah, this is the doco he's doing with the Foo Fighters guy, Dave Grohl, isn't it?
Dave Grohl, he's amazing.
Yeah,
we love Dave Grohl.
Right. Okay. But that's interesting. That's interesting.
Right. Okay.
Well, I've never listened to the Foo Fighters. I probably have, but I don't recognise one of their records unless somebody told me it was. That's interesting what you just said. Ringo's never written his life story because he says he can't remember most of it. That's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. The same as Mick Jagger, who famously was given £1 million advance by Weidenfeld and Nicholson to write his memoir. Mm. And he wrote a few chapters and took it in to the editorial director, who read it and said, "Well, this is a bit boring, actually, a mix of, yeah, it is." And then that afternoon, a bike came round with a cheque for the first third of the advance, and he paid it back and never wrote it.
Yeah, well, I don't know. One of these days, I'm determined to get around to writing my life story. Problem is, I'll collapse and die before I've done it, and that'll be a waste of historical fact gone down the tube.
Well, you better do it now, then. You better get on with it.
I'm not surprised that Ringo couldn't remember parts of his life. When he first met Barbara Bach, they were drinking, and I checked this figure twice. Collectively, they were drinking 16 bottles of wine a day.
What?
Yes, yeah, 16 dead, bottles surely. Of wine a day. So,
God, if I drink one bottle of wine these days, I'm reeling like I'm on a ship or something.
Yeah, and me. I totally agree. But anyway, there we go. Right. OK, folks, that's it. Thank you very much indeed. Another chapter of Life on Planet Porky. Ms. Jones, take care and make sure that all goes well for you before we meet again. And to everybody else out there, thank you for listening. And we will be back with you on Planet Porky very soon.
Very often, and this really annoys me, see a police car pulled up on double yellow lines outside the sweet shop.
Well, and they're going in and getting the sweets.
Exactly. Yeah. Why are they allowed to park on double yellow lines to go in and get sweets?
Well, it shows the police have a human heart. The only real road accident.
Does it really?
Yeah, well, it does. Yeah. Anybody who likes a bag of, you know, pineapple chunks or something like that.
Not a euphemism.
Not a euphemism at all. A sherbet dip, perhaps.
we're getting saucy here now.
No, not at all. Now, when I go to Cardiff, I always laugh. Oh, look, there's the road sign in English and below it the road sign in Welsh. Now, that is insulting to the Welsh people, Leslie Ann, because that means that basically the authorities are assuming that a lot of people who live in Cardiff and Swansea are too thick to have ever learnt the English language, and therefore we've got to write things in Welsh for them because these are just Welsh peasants who don't know any better.
You've misunderstood. My father was born Welsh. His parents were born Welsh. Yep. His grandparents were born Welsh. But they were in the south of Wales and they never spoke Welsh. They spoke English.
Yep.
Because English had been imposed by the English.
Imposed? Dating
way back.
William Wallace. You can take our freedom, but you cannot take our language. Never mind the pink prawns. The pink prawns disappeared the moment I found the yellow bananas. You know,
come on, it's too early in the day for that kind of thing.